Welcome to Curious Campus, a discussion about science, discovery, and culture, brought to you by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I'm your host, Howie Magnet. When the weather warms up, it's hard to beat spending time near the Great Lakes. Whether it's an afternoon of fishing, a sightseeing cruise, or even just lounging on the shore for some rest and relaxation, Lake Michigan and the rest of the Great Lakes are national treasures. They're also the largest freshwater ecosystem in the world. For scientists like Rebecca Clapper, they're a living, interactive resource and classroom to conduct research that contributes to efforts to keep the Great Lakes clean. Clapper is a vice dean and professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. On today's show, we'll talk with Clapper about her research into nanomaterials, which are minuscule chemical particles that seep out of countless products, such as cosmetics, medicine, food, and car batteries, and end up in our waterways. How do these nanomaterials affect organisms that live in the Great Lakes and the Great Lakes ecosystem? And in turn, how does that affect us? We'll also learn a little bit more about the School of Freshwater Sciences, which is the only such school of its kind in the United States. So let's get started. Rebecca Clapper, welcome to Curious Campus.
Thanks for having me.
So for people who might not be familiar with it, what do we mean by the collective term freshwater sciences, and what are some of the fields of study and research that are involved with it?
Yeah, good question. It's kind of a catch-all term for a lot of different areas of research, and it could be anything from the amount of freshwater resources that we have available for drinking and for, you know, human use. It could be what kinds of issues are there surrounding the health of freshwater systems and freshwater ecosystems? How does the contaminant load in freshwater systems affect organisms in those systems or affect humans that rely on those systems for fishing, swimming, drinking activities? It also, in our school, involves policy. So we have economics and policy folks that tell us, you know, how valuable is this freshwater resource to the human population, and what kinds of regulations and incentives do we need to put in place in order to protect those resources so that the things that we value about them stay in place for a long period of time.
It's the only such school of its kind in the nation, correct?
That's right. And so there are other schools that maybe focus on the ecosystem kind of part of it, or ecology. They look at maybe small streams or lakes. But we are using a more global approach because there's so many important issues that are related to this resource that we all rely on for life that are go beyond just the ecology of our freshwater.
So you mentioned the resource aspect of it, and those of us who live near Lake Michigan may really take it for granted. So it could help if you could remind everybody what makes the Great Lakes such an important resource for water research and for our lives in general.
For those who live along the Great Lakes, really appreciate, you know, their size, for one thing, and how much water there is there. I have friends that come and visit from other places in the United States, other places in the world, colleagues that come here, and they just don't realize how massive the Great Lakes are. And we all know how important they are, right? We use them for our drinking water. We use them for recreating, for fishing. And also they're important for transportation of our goods across the Great Lakes and also across the world. And so they're important for a variety of different reasons.
And so that's, I'm guessing, a big reason why we're devoting so many resources to it and why we put so much attention on studying it here in Milwaukee. And part of that is you know, the research vessels that you have involved in that as well, right?
That's right. You know, we're a kind of a unique school in that we're located right on the Great Lakes and on Lake Michigan. And other places may study the Great Lakes, but they have, you know, they're an inland campus or an inland research facility. And we're able to go out our back door and hop on our research vessel. Right now, that's the Niske or one of our smaller boats, and go out and study our waterways that, and also the lake itself, Lake Michigan. We've even had transportation up to like Green Bay and other places in Lake Michigan too with our trusty research vessel. And we're in the process of fundraising for a new research vessel, a much larger one. The one we have right now is from the Korean War era. And so it's, it's a trusty vessel that we've, patched together multiple years now. And we see the need for a bigger, better vessel, one that we can take more people out on. Since we have our new education program, we really want to take lots of students out and really teach them about this great freshwater resource and everything about it. But then also for doing our research, really having more tools available on the ship, more modern tools that we can use in order to study everything from invertebrates to fish to nutrients to weather patterns to all sorts of things.
It's a really good segue into a principal area of your research. So you're the director of the Great Lakes Genomic Center at UW-Milwaukee, and that's a bit of a mouthful.
It is.
So first off, what do you mean by genomics, and what are the types of things that you're studying at the center?
Yeah. Most people are probably familiar with genomics in relationship to the Human Genome Project. So back when I was an undergrad, there was a bunch of resources devoted by the federal government to sequencing the whole human genome. So each of our cells has a genetic material in it, chromosomes that have genes on them that are the pattern that dictates what proteins end up getting created in each of our cells in our body. And so genomics can be anything from studying what do those genes look like and do we have defects in certain genes, for instance, in humans that lead to particular diseases, to gene expression. So each of those genes is coding for a protein. And so it goes from the gene pattern to messenger RNA, gets translated to messenger RNA, and then translated into a protein that actually does something in the cells. And not all of those genes get turned on at the same time, and some of them get turned off from making certain things at certain times. And so one of the things that we do in the Genomics Center is look at which genes are being turned on or off in particular tissues in an organism, and how does that end up telling us something about how the organism is behaving in relationship to its environment? If it comes in contact with a toxin, is it really turning on a bunch of machinery in order to deal with that toxin in order to get back to a normal state so that it doesn't harm the organism? And so in that way, it's, again, very similar to human biology and human genome studies, and where we're trying to figure out, in this case, not how the human genome reacts to the environment or what kinds of defects are there, but how does the environment interact with things that are being introduced into it? Another great use of the genomic tools is monitoring for things like COVID in wastewater. We have a researcher there, Sandra McClellan, and her lab is one of the few in the world that started looking for COVID and COVID variants in wastewater as a sign of how our population was being exposed to those particular viruses. And so she's able to detect the gene sequence of the virus in sewage samples. And she uses that also for detecting different bacteria species that may be harmful to humans or wildlife.
It's basically an early warning system for COVID, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And an early warning system for bacterial contamination too. Right now, sometimes you'll see beach closures because of the bacterial load that's on beaches. Sandra's lab has been able to tell where does that bacteria come from. So there are different sequences depending on whether it comes from a cow or a bird or a dog or whatever. Those of you who have been to Bradford Beach here in Milwaukee have seen the dogs running up and down the beach. One of the reasons is because Sandra's research indicated that birds were a major polluter of bacteria on that beach that was causing some of the closure happenings. And so by running dogs up on the beach, it scares away the birds and you decrease some of the bacterial load on the beach.
So the dogs get good exercise.
Exactly. Yeah. What a great solution, right?
So I think what you're getting at a lot of this is contaminants, right? And I know your work involves emerging contaminants. So the phrase itself seems to imply things that can be harmful to freshwater systems. So what can you tell us about those? What should we know about those?
Yeah, so there are several what we call more legacy contaminants like mercury, methylmercury, that the mercury originates from power plants and then gets laid it into this methyl mercury in the environment that's harmful to people. There's PCBs that folks have heard about from electronics and electrical machinery. But there are these things we call emerging contaminants that are either new to the marketplace or relatively new, or we're just now able to detect them at the levels they're found in water systems. Most of the time, this means that they're at really low concentrations. And so it's taken us a while to figure out how to measure them. And then when we do, we measure them everywhere because they're just, it's very tiny amounts. So, but it still doesn't mean that they couldn't be of concern. And so one of the major mountains to climb is trying to figure out, are any of those contaminants harmful to humans or wildlife? And so we might detect them in a bunch of different places, but if they're at what we say nanogram per liter ranges in the environment, if you think about one of the types of emerging contaminants is pharmaceuticals. And so if you think of a pill you take, it's often in milligrams or thousands of milligrams. So we're talking about, you know, several orders of magnitude smaller amounts in the environment. Does that really cause an impact or not? And that's one of the questions we try to answer in my lab.
So I know a big area of your research focus is nanomaterials. And I'm hoping that you can share with our audience a little bit more about what nanomaterials are and perhaps what you found in your most recent study about them that was published in May.
Sure. Yeah. So nanomaterials are a chemical particulate that's less than 100 nanometers in size in any one dimension. And so if you think about that, that's smaller than a red blood cell. So they're very small. And they're being used for everything from your sunscreens. So titanium dioxide, zinc oxide particles are in a lot of sunscreens, and all the way to electronics, our computer screens, some medicines. They're being used to transport medicines to tumors, for example, and lock onto tumors and they're trying to get them to just deliver the chemotherapy agent just to that tumor or to be an imaging agent just for that tumor, for example. Agriculture, they're being developed as fertilizers. So there's great hope in the in these types of materials. They're a technology that's been in development for the last couple of decades, but they can be made of all different types of chemicals. And the reason why they're so attractive is that down at that size range, the surface area is really large compared to the size of the particle. So they're really reactive. So the nanoparticles that are in your sunscreens, for example, are much more effective at reflecting radiation or absorbing radiation than the bigger size particles. And they also go on a lot smoother. So, you know, it used to be when you caked on zinc oxide on your, you know, it'd be this white paste. And they've, with these nano formulations, they're a lot clearer. It's not as, you know, chalky, cakey. But the question is, you know, just like other emerging contaminants with these new chemicals, do they have any kind of potential impact on the environment? And so that's what we've been studying. And the other thing that we've been studying is, you know, what are some of the benefits to using these chemicals, because they're this novel technology, sometimes they could potentially improve our environmental situation. So the hope is for the agricultural chemicals that maybe we would be able to use less because they're more targeted. Same thing with the chemotherapy agents I just mentioned. Instead of dosing your whole body with some chemical that's really toxic to all your cells, if you can target the cells that you really want to kill, it would be more, you know, a healthier version of a cancer therapy, for example.
So I'd like to explore nanomaterials a little bit more and perhaps how your research might help clean up the Great Lakes, because it sounds like there's a lot there. But before we do that, I kind of want to get into a little bit more about how you got into this field in the first place, because it doesn't sound like it's something that you just kind of slip into. You really kind of have to want to do this type of work. So
yeah.
What can you tell us about how you got involved with it?
Well, I as a kid, I was really into being outside. My dad was a high school biology teacher, and he took us on camping trips all the time. And so I got into science that way, just for a love of nature. When I got into high school, I really loved chemistry. My chemistry teacher was fantastic, And so when I got to grad school and onward, the merging of the biological, ecological, and chemistry was really an interest of mine. And so I started out studying plant chemicals and how they influence things that eat them, so insects and other things. And then I did a fellowship after my graduate career at the Environmental Protection Agency. And these nanomaterials were just starting to come into play in the marketplace right about then. And so when I got my position here at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, it was one of the things I wanted to study. How do these little tiny new types of chemicals end up interacting with organisms in the environment?
It seems to me like it's a area of study that not a whole lot of people know about, and yet it's an area that could have an outsized importance in terms of our daily lives. So I'm kind of wondering what the general awareness is in the public discourse of these nanomaterials and how they affect freshwater systems, perhaps compared to when you first got into the field.
Yeah, I think at the beginning there were some, I think one of the major ways that people got introduced to nanomaterials were through fiction. So Michael Crichton's Prey was like all about these little nanobots that took over a person's body. And so I think there was a lot of fear. And I think even now still people worry about the impacts of these things as they sound very futuristic. But I, like I said, I think there are, holds a lot of promise in this field of using these things for the greater good. Some of the materials that we're studying, for example, are put into batteries that were being used for, you know, a lot of things are going electric now. And so one of the things that we're doing is with the chemists in our Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, which I'm a part of, it's a National Science Foundation funded center. We're investigating how can you manipulate the chemistry of the materials to make them less toxic, for example, or easier to recycle or more effective. One of the other things we're studying is the agricultural impacts that I was mentioning. Could we use these materials to decrease the amount of nutrients we have to spread on a farm field? And all of those things end up impacting our water resources. I think one of the key things that I discovered as a grad student and then coming into my life as a professor is that basically everything that we use in society ends up in our waterways in one way or another, either as trash or as runoff or through our sewage treatment system. And so trying to figure out, you know, which one of those things do we need to pay most attention to has been really key to my research.
You're listening to Curious Campus, a discussion about science, discovery, and culture brought to you by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I'm your host, Howie Magner, and today we're talking about research that can help to improve the health of the Great Lakes with Rebecca Clapper. She's a vice dean and professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UWM. One of the things that people might have heard in terms of news regarding contaminants in water is something that's abbreviated as PFAS, right?
Right.
I'm not going to try to pronounce what it means because I'd make a fool of myself. But perhaps you could tell us what PFAS stands for and why we need to worry about it.
So these are the perfluorinated alkylated substances. And what that means is that there's a bunch of fluorines around the outside of this carbon chain structure. And sometimes they have other chemical structures on the end. But these things are key in that they've been put in all sorts of different products because they were chemically valuable. They are repellent of stains, repellent of water. They are hydrophobic and hydrophilic, and so they have these great properties that, like I said, they were used for all sorts of things. Anti-stick cookware. They've been used in plastics. They are used in ski wax to make your skis slipperier. And so there's Gore-Tex, all sorts of stuff these things were put into. They're used in metal plating to put on top of the vat that they're used for metal plating. It's been put into wrappers for fast food. And so we are starting, again, it's one of those where we kind of knew they were out there, but now we're recognizing that they're out there everywhere because we have better ways of detecting them down to the nanogram per liter range, which is really tiny. And along with that came studies showing that down in that nanogram per liter range, they might be harmful to especially developing organisms, so developing people. And one of the things is that all of us have these compounds in our body because they're so ubiquitous in our products in the marketplace.
And part of the problem, if I understand it, is they don't go away, right?
Yeah, those fluorines around the outside of the compound make them very difficult to break down. And so there aren't a lot of things in the environment that deal with those compounds. And so they sit there for a long time. And so they're found all over the place. The other major reason that we find them out in the environment are firefighting foams. The firefighting foams for very high heat fires. And so a lot of the places that they're detected at higher levels are at airports or at military bases where they were used to put out oil fires, gas fires, tire fires, you know, planes landing on a runway, military grade fires, that kind of thing. And so this stuff was used in a high amount in these very specific locations that caused greater contamination.
So what is the goal in studying them? Are we trying to make better ones? Are we trying to learn how to remove them from the environment better? What's the goal?
Well, I think, one of the things that's really important, since we're starting to discover that they might be dangerous for development of humans and other animals, that they are important for some cancers and possibly obesity and some other things, is that, we need to figure out exactly what's out there and where it's found. And there have been some studies trying to figure out how humans are exposed to the greatest extent so we can limit exposure. Mm-hmm. And then there are all sorts of folks trying to research technologies to remove these things from the environment because they're very difficult to remove. The long chain ones, we can use some of our traditional methods like activated carbon, for example, this type that you have in your Brita filter. But for some of the smaller ones, because this is a class of compounds, it's a whole suite of different compounds. There are hundreds of them. And so it's not just one type of compound we're trying to remove. It's a bunch of them. And so some of them are big and some of them are small as far as their length of the carbon chain. The ones that are small are very difficult to remove right now.
So people don't know this, and there would be no reason for them to, but you and I kind of worked together on a story that appeared in the 2019 edition of UWM Research Magazine. And the story covered your work with nanomaterials. And in that story, you described your work as essentially exploring the idea of building safer chemicals. Also, as part of your work, you mentioned that you're looking for more of a collaborative approach to doing this rather than an adversarial approach with the manufacturers of these materials. So I'm just kind of wondering how you go about doing all of this.
Yeah, so our Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology is really great. It's a, this type of field is what I love. It's crossing the boundary between traditional biology and environmental science, engineering, and chemistry. And so we have all those kinds of folks in our center that are looking at different ways of making particles, how they interact with organisms, membranes in organisms and plants, and how you can model where these things go, how they might chemically interact. And so because you have this fantastic collaboration of a bunch of different researchers, we're able to ask questions that maybe you aren't able to ask if you're just if it was just me, the biologist, ecologist person in the room with some chemistry knowledge. I have, just a subset of knowledge in this area. When you have this group of people, you can ask many different questions. And some of those are, how do you redesign the chemical? So if you're working with chemists then that are making the particles, then you have the tool set there and the person that has tremendous knowledge about how do you remake those chemicals and still have them perform the function they're supposed to perform, but maybe are less toxic to organisms.
Because the work is to kind of avoid, for lack of a better term, and, reprimand me if I'm making too big of a deal of this, but environmental catastrophes, right?
Right.
In the story, you mentioned the example of asbestos, right? And people thought that this was a great thing until they realized that it wasn't because it did so much harm. So the hope is that if you can work with people on these nanomaterials now, you can avoid something down the road akin to asbestos, right?
That's right. Yeah. Or even the PFAS example that you gave. I mean, that was used for decades. You think of what we know about chemicals and how they interact with organisms, 50 years ago is very different than the way we think about chemicals now. And so it's not just the way we make the chemicals, but also how we test them. And so you mentioned the paper that we just had published this past month in Nature Nanotechnology. And this was through our Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology. And the lead author was my student, Becky Curtis. And it was a whole suite of people looking at how do particular nanoparticles interact with different organisms. So one of the questions that we have is not just how does the chemical interact with one organism and does it cause toxicity, but could you make predictions going across organisms as to how toxic a chemical is? And it's another way that we're able to be protective of the environment. If you're able to really represent a broader suite of organisms in the environment, there are some that are very sensitive and some that are not. And can you make that prediction ahead of time as to who's going to be most sensitive to this chemical and who's going to be most resistant to the chemical, and then base your regulations or the making of your chemicals on that sensitive organism.
I'd like to reserve a little bit of time to talk about the School of Freshwater Sciences in general. It's, as we mentioned before, the only such school in the country. And it recently just introduced its first undergraduate program. Prior to that, it had been a graduate school-only course of instruction. So how has the first year gone for this undergraduate program? Why was this program important to implement? And what does the future hold?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're so excited about our undergrad program and all of our programs, really. We started out as a graduate school with a professional master's program and then also the traditional research thesis and dissertation tracks, master's, PhD. And our placement rate for our professional master's thesis and dissertation students is something like 94%. So 94% of our students go out and get jobs in some kind of water science, and a few of them go other places. But really, we're so excited that we're able to provide this background that really is important for the marketplace. Water science is just going to grow in importance. One of the things that, because of that graduate program, people were starting to ask us about having an undergrad program, because there are lots of undergrads that are very excited about this topic. It's really a very important topic. And so we decided to create an undergraduate program to complement the graduate program. And so we had our first crop of students this year. We're coming to the end of the second semester. And so we had about 20 students this year. We've had about 40 apply for our next year. And this was without a lot of advertising. We've just started up our advertising. And so we're so excited that people have found us and that they want to participate in our program of study. One of the other exciting things that just happened in the last couple of weeks is that we had approval to have a bachelor's master's combined program where students can go for 5 years and get a bachelor's and a master's degree. And like I said, our graduate program, we have a 93-94% placement rate. And so one of the parts of that program then is getting them into internships and opportunities to interact with companies or in nonprofit agencies or government, other academic institutions, so that they can build their tool set so that they can get a better job at the end. And so we're excited that that's part of our repertoire of courses of study now, too, is that not only can you get a bachelor's or get a master's or beyond, you can do that combined 5-year degree and then get out and get a job.
What type of students are you attracting to these programs?
It's a diverse set of students. So our graduate programs generally attract folks that are coming back and retooling. They've been out in the marketplace. They've worked in all sorts of different jobs, whether it be environmental jobs or industry jobs, or, you know, they were working at, they got a liberal arts degree and then went and worked at the coffee shop and are interested in fresh water and just didn't have a way to explore that. And then they get this background and then are able to move into the water sector. And then we also have some traditional students that have gone through their bachelor's program and jump right into to graduate degree. For our bachelor's program, we have a wide variety of students. We've got several veterans that have joined us. So they went off and did military service and came back and now are interested in getting a water degree. And, you know, maybe they had some experience with water science in their military service, but they might have just, you know, that's just an interest of theirs. And then we have folks that are interested in the environment. All of our students, one of the things that I like to talk to our students about is their water story. Because a lot of them have, you know, they grew up wherever, some from Wisconsin, some from other places, and their memories are of, you know, going and playing in a creek or boating or fishing as a kid. And that's how they got into their interest in freshwater science. And so that's the most exciting part is just hearing, you know, how they got interested in this in the first place.
Understood. And I think people will expect that the school will have researchers and scientists like yourself as part of it. But they might be surprised to know that you've also got economists and a lawyer and social scientists as part of the Freshwater Sciences School. So why are these experts there and what type of perspectives can they bring to the studies?
Oh, yeah. And this is one of the things that's kind of unique about our program is that we have a policy track as well. So you can come in and do policy-related research or have an undergrad program that's more, it's water related, but it also has policy and econ in it. And those faculty are super important. You know, we're only able to protect the environment if people think that it's an important resource. And so really figuring out how folks value that resource, in order to do that, we need these kind of faculty. So we need folks that understand how do you put a monetary value on that resource and how do people spend their money related to that resource. How do people feel about that resource and how would that relate to how they're willing to have it regulated? and what kind of incentives do you need in order to get people to protect the resource, use it in a certain way. And so it's very important that we have those researchers in our school.
So I'm going to wrap things up with what no doubt is a bit of a broad question, but I'm sure you can answer all aspects of it in a couple of minutes. So what in general is science telling us about the health of the Great Lakes right now?
The Great Lakes, I like to say, is a really dynamic system. It's changed so much over the last several decades. First, we could say it changed for pollutants, but now it really invasive species have caused a tremendous shift in the food web structure of the lake. And so it's always changing with whatever insult is being thrown at it, I guess, or whatever else is going on in the environment. Right now, we're talking a lot about climate change and the influence of changes in rainfall events and major shifts in the periodicity of rainfall, for example. One of the things I didn't mention is that our atmospheric science program at UWM just joined our School of Freshwater Sciences. And we just hired someone who's starting in the fall who studies climate change and the influence on water events that happen. Many of us around the Milwaukee area in particular are familiar with the street flooding that happens every once in a while with our huge rain events. And so that's also critically important. And it influences our lake and influences all of our freshwater systems. So it's really changed a lot. And with each change, we're excited about studying what that means for humans and also the organisms that live in the lake.
It really is not an exaggeration to say that this is something that affects us all. And because of that, it's well worth studying. So you've got a lot of work to do, I'm guessing.
Yes, and exciting work. I think all of us, one of the reasons I came to work at UWM and at the School of Freshwater Sciences is my love of the Great Lakes and wanting to be close by to the Great Lakes where I grew up. So it's important to everyone at our school.
Well, Rebecca, thanks for reminding us of that. And thanks for sharing some of your time with us today on Curious Campus.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Sure. And that's today's show. Thanks for listening. Our guest today was Rebecca Clapper, Vice Dean and Professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. Curious Campus is produced by Gennaro Armas. Our engineer is Jason Reavy, and I'm your host, Howie Magner. If you enjoyed our show, please consider subscribing on your favorite podcast app.